All right, folks, get your finger out and pit your football knowledge against Team OTB to win big. There's €2,500 for the winner of the OTB Final One Standing League on the William Hill app. Guaranteed winner, and it's exclusive to our own league. Just sign up at William Hill Final One Standing. Use the code OFFTHEBALL, that's all one word and all caps, and make sure you sign up before Friday the 15th at 8 o'clock when the new season kicks off. €2,500 to the winner, guaranteed.
Settle in on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 00.
All right, you're very welcome along to the very latest episode of Settle In. I'm delighted to say we're welcoming Michael McKillop to Settle In today. Michael, how are you getting on?
I'm good, yourself?
All good, how's life?
It's good. It's different to what it used to be. But yeah, very much enjoying the process that I'm in right now.
You've really let yourself go in the few years since you've been retired. You're obviously keeping very active.
Yeah, I'm trying to do as much as I can. Realistically, for me, losing what I had as a full-time athlete was a shock to the system, and it did take a couple of months to really grasp why I was doing it. It was more than competitiveness, obviously, naturally, but for my mental health and my physical well-being as well, it had a massive bonus, in a way, of being a full-time athlete. And then whenever you're now stepping away from it, you realise a couple of months down the line that, oh God, I maybe need to get my arse in gear and kind of get back being fit. And now I'm in a position where I'm about 4 years down the line that I'm still back trying to get into it a wee bit. My body doesn't allow me to do the same amount of training, but I've found alternatives, so I'm in the pool a lot more, and I'm on the bike as well. So I'm doing a bit of triathlon work, which is quite fun. It's new and it's
easy on the body, or easier on the body,
but it's a lot harder in terms of you're having to do like three double days a week. I even know they're obviously off feet most of the time, but it's still tired. You still get very tired, but it's a challenge. And I guess when you're in high performance sport your whole life, from a teenager up until you're a grown man, that's what you're trying to look for now. And unfortunately, I've found myself in that position.
Are you doing that competitively, or is it scratching itch?
Scratching an itch for now. Where it takes me, I don't know. We'll see what avenue it takes me. Hopefully, I would love to be competitive, but you just never know. When you're taking up a new sport, you can give it a go, but whether or not that's at a good enough level. Running takes care of itself. The bike is kind of good because I had good endurance. It's more the swimming that I found a little way more challenging. It's a lot technical stuff. So I'm really homing in on my swimming at the minute. And it's good to have Olympics and Paralympians as friends as well that they've done it on the highest stage in the pool. So I can always go for them for some advice, which is always a good thing.
I love how your approach to this is not like Joe Soap, who'd be like, I'll sample a little bit of this stuff, I'll enter a race, we'll see how we go. You're like, I have friends who can tell me how I can be the best at this thing.
Yeah, like it's funny because like the first thing that I did, I said I wanted to learn how to swim, and this is how this all came about. Right. I just wanted to learn how to swim. I couldn't swim more than 50 metres. I took panic attacks when I was in the pool. So I was like, I want to do this not only for myself, but my son, to be confident in the water. And I went straight away to swim analysis. I wanted to know exactly what I was doing right and what I was doing wrong. I didn't do anything right, really. The only thing I did right was I was being in the pool. Everything else I was doing wrong, but it was nice because then I could go away and figure out what I needed to do on the advice of the coach. And it's quite nice. And I think, again, going back to the high performance side of things, it gave me something to challenge myself. And that's the thing that I've missed whenever you step away from high performance sport, and you always, like you said, scratch that itch that has turned into a big massive itch.
Yeah. Have you always been like that, sort of that analytical thing in all aspects of your life? It's an obvious thread as to why you were as successful as you were. But
yeah, whenever I was in my prime and kind of even in my early years, everything was so detailed. My coach, my dad was so detailed, but it wasn't even just my dad. It was psychologists, it was a physiotherapist, it was strength and conditioning coaches, went down to the nth degree to make sure that what I was doing was bespoke for me. Growing up with a disability, it makes a little slight different because I'm not your just stereotypical able-bodied athlete that can do all these exercises. There would have had to be modifications and that sort of stuff. And that's why for me now in my own competitive life, now after obviously being in elite sport, I look for the nth degree, which sometimes is difficult to appreciate because you can't just do anything for fun, sadly. Mm-hmm. And it was like when I did Dublin Marathon, it said I wanted to do it for charity. After 2 weeks, I knew finally I wanted to run as fast as I possibly could. So the training completely changed from having a bit of fun doing it, running a few days a week, to all of a sudden having a full-on marathon plan. So it's just the personality that I am, and I don't think I'll ever get away from it.
Do you rail against that, or do you just understand that's part of your makeup, your DNA, and if I sign up to this thing, I know, as you said yourself, fine, well, in a couple of weeks' time, or do you rail against that a little bit?
At times, I wish I could just enjoy it a little bit more. Not because I do enjoy it, but it's more those, don't worry about it, it's not it, that's fine. Yeah. If I was to go out and not hit the markers that I was set by the coach, or I didn't hit the kind of specific times that I wanted, I would straight away question it and go, well, what could I have done better? Mm. Whereas I should be at the stage of my life to just go, don't worry about it anymore. And that's what I felt. And I don't know of other elite athletes that are in retirement, but that's what I thought the afterlife, as I call it, would be. It would just be, I couldn't care less. I was doing this for the fun. But once you get back into it, you cannot lose that competitive personality. That's why we did it. We did it because we wanted to be better than the other person on the track or on the pitch or wherever it may have been. So for me, I'll always hold on to that, and hopefully my son gets a bit of it. I don't want him to feel like he has to take up sport just because his dad was a sports person. I want him to explore whatever he wanted to do and to go on a journey in his own life. I'll support him whatever he does. But sport for me was where I learned to become who I am today. And that was through opportunities that my dad and my mum gave me.
We were chatting a little bit outside, and you're saying that maybe the majority of your time is spent being a stay-at-home dad, which must be, and we'll get into that, an incredibly rewarding aspect of life. But your fitness instructor by times as well, is that right?
Well, I got qualifications throughout my running career. It was kind of a pastime. It was kind of one of those things that I did to keep myself sane. In a way, I went and did a wee course that I could do. I fall back on it now in a bit because obviously you have to keep up to date with all your qualifications, yeah, what I haven't done. But for me, it's more, I have knowledge, I have experience. I am coach running now. I'm helping the general public fall in love with the sport that I loved. I wanted to educate them as much as possible and help them succeed in whatever goals they may set for themselves, and try and encourage them to have a better understanding of what running is, because a lot of people just think running is, oh, you go out in a wee 5K and then you're done. There's so much more, and they expect so much from themselves, when in actual fact, I have to rein it all in. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going back on what my dad did for me. It's kind of like putting everything in perspective and giving them an understanding of why they're doing it, and it simplifies everything. And I think that's why I enjoy coaching now, because I've been there, I've done that, and I know what to do and what not to do and what athletes want and what athletes don't want. And I think for the general public, a lot of people expect too much upon themselves.
The coaching thing actually is the reason that I asked you about that, because a lot of what you were describing, that attention to detail and outright thirst for perfection, I suppose, would go down especially well as a, maybe, you know, coach of elite athletes. Is that something you've considered or you would look at? Or
yeah, I would love to go down that route. And further on the year, I'm hopefully going to be doing all my coach qualifications all in a big spurt. There's being up north, obviously a part of UK coaching, and there's an opportunity for ex-Olympians and Paralympians to be given all your coaching qualifications over a very quick space of time. And that's something I want to aspire to do, okay, because I would love to be involved in elite sport. But for now, just like anyone taking up sport or a new role, you have to do grassroots first and develop into what I'm doing. Even though, yes, I know how to coach an elite athlete, but to be honest, the prima donnas. I was a prima donna. Like, they're so needy. They expect so much from you. So dealing with the general public, and like I said, try and get them to fall in love with the sport first, and then potentially show my ability to be a good coach, and to then further down the line go into potentially the elite side of things. But for me now, I have to learn my craft. I wouldn't be able to go, turn around and go, yeah, I'll go on, I'll be an international coach. That doesn't happen.
You don't want to do an Andy Murray on it and go, no. Go straight in.
No, and I think it for the respect of the sport as well, I'm learning. I'm learning from the best person, my dad, who was my coach my whole career. And I think if I can do it step by step gradually, then yeah, 100%, that's an avenue I would like to go down.
We never get into the full introduction. So, four-time Paralympian, four-time gold medalist between the 800 and 1500 metres, six-time World Championship gold medalist, considered one of the, if not the greatest Paralympic athlete, middle distance Paralympian of all time. It doesn't fully capture your entire career, but some of the big benchmarks of it all sound fair enough.
Yeah, it does. There's a few more World Championships in there, but like for me, when I look back at my career and look back at stats, and it's wonderful to have, and the medals are amazing, but for me, it's memories. It's the people I met. It's the countries I visited. It's the cultures I learned about. It's the faiths that I got to have a better understanding with. And for me, that to me is way more beneficial for the growth of me personally, but also my family and my son and that sort of stuff, because one of my best friends, Jason Smith, he's a Mormon. So straight away, that was a topic of conversation that we always had early on in our relationship and our friendship. And for me to understand that, because a lot of people would automatically say, oh, does Jason, is he Catholic? Is he Protestant? Is this, that and the other? And I'm just like, no, he's not. Mm-hmm. So don't put someone in a certain box just because of it. And that was kind of nice. And then obviously, when you go internationally, you get to meet amazing people. And some of my good friends now are living across the world, but one of my very close friends, he's South African. I would have competed against him when I was younger, and he moved on, but like, he's due to come over in November. He wants to come and see South Africa against Ireland in the rugby. So we haven't seen each other in probably about 5 years. So it's one of those things, is trying to really grasp why sport is important. And sport for me, the older I got, was the realization that it's more about the people and the memories than it is the medals.
Yeah. We'll hop around here a little bit, but there was like the as you're chatting there about it, the Scotty Scheffler stuff from Portrush the other week, you know, the world number one in golf. Everybody's seen this thing by now, but the entire piece, 5 minute sort of chat, was what's the point, was kind of the gist of it. He said, you know, it's not fulfilling from the deepest place of your heart. I love the challenge, love playing the game for a living, but sometimes I don't understand the point. Now, he's obviously currently knee deep in putting together possibly, certainly one of the most sensational careers of all time. May end up being the most. We shall see how all that plays out. But I just wonder, and you've kind of hinted at it from your point of view, from your standpoint, having retired, it sounds like you're very much understanding of that sort of what's the point, or that compartmentalization of sport and life.
Yeah, there's two separate identities. And I think for young, up-and-coming, aspiring elite athletes, once you understand that there's two things to life, and family and friends and jobs and whatever it may be are one, and your role within your career, whether that be in team sport or individual sport, is two different things. And once you can grasp that, that's going to benefit you in the long run, because you have to understand that what happens at home cannot come onto the track. What happens at home can't go onto the golf course. And I think that's where Scotty's kind of talking about that. So what is the point? The point is, obviously, for him, is to go and win. And if he does that on the course, we always talk about golf. Golf is more mental than it is physical at some cases, and especially whenever it's crucial putts and it's missing the cut or not missing the cut. And I think for him, he is able to understand the reasoning why he does it. The purpose is golf. It's not life. It's not life or death. If he misses a putt, he moves on to the next one. And I think that's important also for young athletes, is realising that just you've ran one bad race or you've lost one football match doesn't mean that you're the worst team or the worst person, you made a mistake. You can go back, reassess, self-evaluate or team evaluate, and then go and do it again, because people always talk about failure. For me, failure doesn't exist. What you've just done is experience something that didn't go 100% right, and that's where your self-evaluation comes in, and then you get to go and experience it again. It's like passing a driving test. Not everyone does it the first time. Mm-hmm. You go away, you learn, and then you do it again, and then you pass, and then you're able to go and do it on your own. So there's so many ways you can look at life. But yeah, putting in sport and life into perspective, they are two separate things, but some people just collectively put it all together and then get confused throughout halfway through the career.
I think the reason it was so interesting from him was that where he's at in his career at the minute, because you often hear maybe people like yourself who are 4 or 5 years out of it saying, oh, you know, I now can reflect on this thing and I realise maturely. Were you always aware of that when you were needing
no,
the competition?
No, my understanding of that kind of feeling was whenever, and I realised actually Michael McCulloch, the runner, can struggle. Just because he's in front of a camera and just because he has gold medals doesn't mean that he can't be not okay. Mm. And that for me, whenever I realised that actually, do you know what? I have family and friends there for a purpose. They're there to help and support and guide. I felt I couldn't speak, and it goes for a lot of people, and I'm sure there is a lot of people that are watching this right now that are in high performance sport or whatever it may be, and realise the actual fact that you can talk, and that for me is important, and I learned the hard way. Having to go through the struggles because I was afraid to speak out and ask for help, where in actual fact, that gave me a new lease of life. It gave me a real purpose of why I was doing it. And the purpose was competitiveness, drive and hunger, we've talked about it, wanting to be the best and using what I've been given. My disability is my unique selling point. If it wasn't for my disability, I wouldn't be in the Paralympic Games. So it's a privilege to have a disability for me personally. I've used it to my full potential, and I've got a lot from it. And for me, that's life experience that I'll always talk about for whoever wants to listen.
Was that, that's amazing, by the way. Was that because you were invested so much, like it, you hadn't reached that Scotty Scheffler bit of understanding, you were invested so much in your sport and the outcome of it and it being you, essentially. Was that part of that?
Yeah, that was 100% it, because at that moment in time in my life, like I said, I was Michael the runner. I wasn't anything else. I was institutionalised. I went full-time at the age of 17. I retired when I was 31. I didn't have a full-time job. I never went to university. I never went to college. I left that system because I felt and I thought I needed to be an elite athlete. And to be a good elite athlete, you had to put every single thing into running. When in actual fact, that's not true. You have to have those things that you can separate things. Family, life, friends, university, education, and competitiveness. And whenever you piece them all together, one of the probably the best people that I've met recently, not met recently because I know him very well, Aidan Walsh, an amazing boxer, an Olympic medalist. But for me, him and Aidan have so good conversations because we and have a better understanding because we both struggle with our mental health, and having that good understanding of what life is about and giving that back to the next generation, because being institutionalised and a lot of people didn't see that, they just seen Michael the runner, and that's where I seen myself. I was looking through the glass at the same person instead of looking within myself, and now that I'm in a privileged position to be out the other end and be still living and still proud of the journey that I've taken, I can then help educate whoever comes. Because I think when you look at Sport Ireland now, they're putting things in place to help encourage athletes. Don't sit in your ass. Don't go and play PlayStation for hours on end. Don't go and watch TV. Go and read a book. Go and learn. Go and speak to people. And that for me is imperative, and I think the more we learn about it, the more we'll give each other the opportunity to become more successful in sport.
You have regrets, obviously, around that stuff, I presume. So how do you reflect on it now? Is that, I made mistakes, maybe I could have got better advice, but that's the way it was. You sounds like you've reached that position in life where you've said, listen, that's part now of what makes me the person I am today, and I don't know, maybe regret is the wrong word.
No, I don't think you should regret anything in life. I think you should put it in perspective of it's happened and how can you deal with that moving forward. Obviously, I wish I had never had the experience mental health issues, but I did. And now what I've went through can potentially help someone else, whether that be if I deliver a talk, whether it's on this podcast that someone's listening, someone might be able to reach out and go ask for help in a mental health charity or whatever it may be. Yeah. That for me is a bonus. Like I deliver talks to young kids in schools, and I know for a fact that I've saved children's lives from giving talks like this. And that's all I can do, is come from experience. I'm not reading from a book, a manual, and going, oh, this is what happens and this is how you feel in this. I felt it. I went through it and I embraced it and I experienced it, and I wouldn't want anyone in this entire world to have to go through what I went through.
It's amazing. We had John McGrath, the Tipperary hurler, on in the last couple of weeks. Amazing success, obviously. And, you know, he was trying to process. Owen asked him, Leo, which of your three All-Ireland medals is your favourite, best or favourite? It's an awful choice to have to make. But I think I mentioned, is it 10? You corrected me earlier on, I think, when I said it was 10 major...
Nine more titles, four Paralympic gold medals.
Four Paralympic gold. So, which is your favourite child, I suppose? Is that the...
Yeah. For me, there's two choices. Beijing, because it was my first ever Paralympic Games, because I was 18 years of age. I was in a stadium of 91,000 people. I was in Beijing. That, for me, was the moment I stepped up and executed precisely on what we wanted to achieve. I was only 18. I'd broken the world record. I'd won my world title. I could have walked away. I could have retired at age 18 and went and had my own normal life. But for me, again, it was always... how good could I become? And because I competed able-bodied as well and ran for Ireland able-bodied, that also probably kept me a little bit more focused, because I was never going to be the best able-bodied athlete. I was always going to be, well, not always, but I was always the best Paralympic athlete. But losing national finals, finishing eighth in national finals, or winning the junior men cross-country championships in Ireland, like, for me, these are the things that made me the athlete I am or was, and these are the things that made me the best Paralympian. And you introduced me as the greatest. That came from Jonathan Edwards, one of the most successful Great Britain long jumpers. And for me, things like that is incredible to know that I was able to accomplish throughout my career. I don't go shouting about it, but it's also nice to know that people appreciate it for what I did, because I always talk about the island, because yes, I do live up north. I live in Northern Ireland, but for me, I represented every single person on this island, because it didn't matter what colour you were, who you were, where you were in orange, where you were in green, whatever it may have been. For me, if you were on my team, you supported me, encouraged me. And that for me was the amazing thing about Irish sport. And it is unique to anywhere else in the world, because you do live in division.
It's a hard balance to walk, coming from where you're coming from, isn't it?
It's very, very much so. It's a balance that I grew up in a very mixed area. So you basically could walk 200 metres and you had to learn how to speak the alphabet in a certain way. And that's how they knew. And like that, growing up, that's what you did. You walked to the end of the street and there's red, white and blue curb zones. So, and you walked 300 metres and then there was the green, white, and orange curbstones. So, like, you had to learn. And if you found yourself in the wrong thing when you were a child, you learned the hard way. And I did learn the hard way once. So it is good to have that as a skill, because I was very open to whoever came my way. I was always friendly because my parents always brought me up to appreciate, doesn't matter who they are, respect them and the way you would want to be respected. And I think, again, going into high-performance sport, you meet so many people. You go and meet people in the media. Everyone's there, obviously, for their story or their understanding, but realistically, we're all there to enjoy life. And for me, that was the best thing about sport, was trying to enjoy it for what it was.
What was learning the hard way, sorry, can I ask, when you said...
I got beat up.
Right.
I got beat up. I went to play football with one of my friends, who ironically was Welsh, and moved over here with his family, and we were down in a local leisure centre, and we were out playing, kicking the football about, and it was just a group of teenagers thinking out the back, and just noticed that there were two young fellas. I was only 11 at the time, 12 at the time, and yeah, I remember getting chased, and I remember getting gripped and stopped and punched in the face, and that was just a part of growing up. And don't get me wrong, I probably lived in the nicer part of just on the outskirts of Belfast. You went into the likes of the inner city, like you speak to Michael Conlon and stories about up the falls and that sort of stuff, and some of the stuff's crazy, but like for me, I did experience it, and it will always experience it, because it's where I live, it's where I grew up, and like in the town that I live now, It's a beautiful, beautiful time, but for a month and a half of the year, it's big arches and Union Jacks flying everywhere and that sort of stuff. But people just get on with it. And that's where I think it's important to realise that, yeah, okay, we may have different faiths, different religions, different things, but smile, say hello and encourage one another, and what will be will be. But life's important to realise that we're all different. We're all different for a reason, and to be happy.
Yeah, it's a good perspective. Hopefully that's the way things are going generally. When I asked you that initial question before we went off on the tangent, you mentioned you mentioned 2008, you're 18. You mentioned, you know, you're competing at the very top level. And actually it struck something with me because we'd Brendan Lawler, the golfer from Louth in here not that long ago. He had only won the G4D Open for the second time a couple of weeks prior to have been in at that point. But he was talking about like that idea of he could have competed against able-bodied golfers. There was, I'd said to him, like, would you have gone to the Challenge Tour? Could have done that. Could have competed against, you know, that level of golfer and could have scrambled around. Maybe if everything had gone my way, I could have sort of got the direction of a tour card. But he said actually he would rather have chosen the path that he did because it gave him a voice, you know, for disability golf in Ireland and way beyond that now. So you actually went down that path, obviously, for a period of time. You won the, would you say, the Irish Cross Country Juniors?
Irish National Junior Cross Country Championship.
And then you went on to the, you were the first Paralympian to compete in the Europeans, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, European Cross Country Championships,
so
yeah.
Was that something you thought at that point, maybe I'll go down this road, or what was the
No, because the simple fact is, my dad, who was the coach of probably 40 teenagers, boys, from an all-boys school, we all trained 5-6 days a week. And then all of a sudden, my dad was realising that actually we were all doing the training within school, and then you had to go and join another club, the running club competition. So my dad set up Smallachy's AC, which then became one of the biggest and best running teams on the island of Ireland. And for me, like having that opportunity to be competitive against all different teams around Ireland, even though we were just a school team, was quite cool because we proved to people that we were the best. And that opened up your opportunities of competing in national cross-country championships, north and south, national track and field championships. And that, for me, was a stepping stone. And, like, growing up, I was competitive against the likes of David McCarthy, like John Travers, people that went on to run sub-4-minute miles and that sort of stuff. And
your times were there, like.
I would have been way more competitive in cross-country than I would have been on track. Like I said, I made three national 1500 metres track and field championships. I finished probably second or third last in the final, but I qualified through the rounds because my craft in winning in para sport made me a good racer. And I would say that that's what I was good at. I was smart and intelligent on the track. I knew I wasn't the best. I was never going to win the national championships, but I knew what I had to do to qualify and be the best. And I think they go hand in hand. And like you say, Brendan, like talking about para sport and para golf and able-bodied golf, like it's the same in track and field. For me, I learned so much from people that I was competitive against in able-bodied sport because they were better than me. And I respected everyone that I competed against. And like even the growth of Irish athletics now in middle distance is crazy. You got the likes of Luke McCann, Andrew Cosker, and you got Nick Griggs up north, and these are people that are taking athletics to a whole different ballgame and a different level, and they're the things that I love to see because I was once surrounded by them. Like before going to Tokyo, I had a training camp out in Portugal, and I was along with the likes of Sean Tobin and people like that, and with Andrew Coskren in the Dublin Track Club, and Andrew went to the Olympic Games, Mark English went to the Olympic Games. So I was training alongside these, and that's what my dad taught me, was it does not have, you don't have to be training with Paralympic athletes. You train with whoever will make you a better person, and surrounding yourself with better people stretches you out of your comfort zone, and then gives you the better perspective of, okay, well, I'm not good enough, then I need to train harder. But then you go on the other side, and I was able to compete against Paralympic athletes, and that's why I always talk about my unique selling point.
Yeah. And it obviously helped you when it came to 2008, that competition. Your expectations going out there were, I'm good enough, I've got the times, I have the intelligence. What were your expectations? Was it, obviously you'd have a will to get gold, but
Yeah, because I was so young, even though expectations was high, I was probably putting so much pressure on myself because I'd won World Championships in 2006 at 16. Like, automatically, running was my be-all and end-all, and that's what I probably talked about earlier on, was the fact that I put so much pressure on myself because I was worried what other people would think, realistically. And I've realised that after Tokyo. You're a headline for a day, and then you're lost, you're done. So if I had won a bronze medal at age 18 in Beijing, people would have talked about it. Oh, it's unbelievable. It's a great opportunity and you set yourself up. But I was only 18, whereas I thought to myself, I have to win gold because if I don't win gold, it's a failure. But then that's where I started to learn that actually, no, I just experienced it. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky and blessed enough that I didn't have to understand what losing was in Paralympic sport because I learned how to do it in able body sport. Mm-hmm. And that was my secret weapon. And that,
you didn't go on to do a pile of it in Paralympic sport.
No, and that's what I said. Like, talking about being, understanding what it feels like not to come across the line first is frustrating. Mm. But that's where attention to detail comes in, and then changing it for Paralympic sport. Yeah. And it goes for a lot. It doesn't. It's not just athletics or running. It's so many things. Business, life in general. You put things into little compartments. It allows you to see it from a completely different perspective.
Yeah. So that one, actually, the John McGrath answer was the most recent one. To be fair to him, he struggled, and I'm not sure he fully, you know, it was 24 or 48 hours after he'd won the thing, yeah. But he went with the most recent one. He did score two goals in the final, to be fair. You've gone with your first Paralympic one as your favourite child of the lot. If we skip on to 2012, you know, you're 22. Had you won the 800 metres or the 1500 metres first?
I had won the 800 metres first.
The 800 first, yeah. And then the 15.
I think I know what you're going to bring up now.
So go for it.
So obviously won the 800 metres, and then I just remember, and I talk about this with school kids because it's hard to believe it's 13 years ago, which is kind of scary also. Yeah. So some of the schools I go into and talk about now, kids weren't even alive. But on that day, the kind of like a couple of minutes before, maybe a half an hour before, it might have been sooner, but my dad pulled me back and he said, if you win, you'll get a surprise. I thought to myself, like, oh, what the heck?
I'm getting a new car.
That's again what I thought. Oh, we're going on holidays, where are we going? What's this? And then a lot of people on here might go, why did your dad say that to you? You're going into the biggest race of your life. And it was because I'd already won the race before I got on the track, because I knew exactly, I'd visualised it. I turned every single thing, and I talk about attention to detail. I turned the invisible, that hadn't happened yet, into the visible, because if you were to go back and watch that race, I could talk you through it moment by moment. If you looked at the 800 metres from Beijing, moment by moment, I could tell you exactly what I was going to do. And that was all pre-planned. So I was on autopilot. I didn't have to. So my dad said that to kind of make it a bit of a joke and make me relaxed and chilled, because I knew fine rightly, once I go into the call room, I go into the track, I execute. And that's where I learned to be perfect on the track in para sport.
That's incredible depth it takes the intelligence, I think, that you talked about. That utter belief that this is what's going to happen. But it obviously comes from knowing the rest of the field, I presume.
And again, it's assessing who was in the race, and like the gentleman, my friend Brad Scott, who would have been. He became known as my pacer because whatever way he tried to run it, I beat him. And predominantly what he was running for was second place. So he always went out hard to try and get a gap so that he had security. So he just dragged me round, and my dad just automatically always said, one lap, I still can tell the instructions, one lap, gradually pick it up. See if you get a gap. And if you do, after 200 metres, then gradually again pick it up. Get to the 800 metres. Get your split, and then it's up to you. You can choose what you want to do. And then I just gradually picked it up 200 after 200 after 200 and then ran the fastest lap. I think I ran a 62.3 lap.
So that's what I was looking at some of your races last night. You were kind of waving to the crowd.
Because at the same time, and lots of people talk about that, and the simple fact is because you see a stadium here, the Aviva Stadium, the London Stadium in London, people paid to come and watch us. We are a show. We're putting on a show. So for me, I was thinking and laughing to myself, I'm just winning this race. I'm winning by such a big margin. But all of that hard work, it deserves to be celebrated. So I was just celebrating a little bit, probably too extravagant.
Listen,
but
it's
at the same
bit of showmanship
time,
showmanship, and you're in the moment.
But it was in the moment, and I remember there's another race that I look. There's usually a camera that comes right down alongside you, and for the last 40 metres, I stared into the camera because I knew I had won. I just stared in the camera because it was funny, because it was just embracing and enjoying the process. My mom didn't appreciate it because she thought it was too cocky, but that you learn from your mistakes.
But there's a bit of showmanship in you.
It has to be, and that brings out personality. Because I'm not a very boisterous person in real life, but for me, I wanted to prove to people that I was the best, and the more I gained from that. But I came off the track after winning. Oh, well, I did my victory lap, picked up the trickler and ran around. That was special. Came off, and then they kind of ushered us back in to get your tracksuit on. Then you have to go to your medal ceremony. And it was a bit rushed, everything. And then I noticed there was only one person presenting or come out to present the flowers and the medals. And I was like, oh, there's something not
right
here.
There's normally to be three or two.
And I stand behind the podium. And then all of a sudden the announcer came on and he's like, and now we would like to invite Miss Catherine McKillop to the stadium to present the T37 1500 metre medals. And I was like, it was like a light bulb moment, you know, that moment of going, I've heard that name before. And then all of a sudden the doors open and my mum walks out and takes a step. And like, for me, and it is quite a nice thing to know, because my mum created history on that night. She became the first mother or father to present her child with an Olympic or Paralympic gold medal.
Wow.
The only other person in the world that has been given the privilege is Princess Anne. And she presented a silver medal to Sarah Phillips. So I always talk about it and joke, laugh, and we say my mum has something up with the royal family. And then that is true.
Why did she do it?
So I was an ambassador for P&G, which was one of the global ambassadors for the Paralympic and Olympic Games in London 2012. So they used it as a publicity stunt.
Okay.
It was me and Katie Taylor and Sonia O'Sullivan were ambassadors for the 2012 Games. And obviously me and Katie were competitive, and Sonia was just the idol that Sonia is. And so it was a mum's campaign. It was the importance of how important mums were in our lives. And obviously Katie's mother is massive in her life. And for me, growing up with a disability, my mum was vital, because I had to go to occupational therapy, speech therapy, physiotherapy, and she was the one bringing me. And so whenever she presented that medal, that was kind of their way of showing to the world, mums are great. And I say it, and the most important thing, dads are role models for every young boy up and coming, and they want to be like their dads. But realistically, if anything goes wrong, you go to your mum. You don't go to your dad, because you're afraid of what your dad are going to think. Your mums are the soft things that will love you dearly, and that's kind of where I'm in a position, because I'm doing something in my personal life now that is not your norm. And I can see why it's important.
I watched it again last night, and forgetting about all that context to it, you'd have a tear in your eye looking at it. It was so beautiful. I presume have you photographs up around? Or
yeah, we have photographs in mom and dad's house, sitting at the kitchen table just on the left-hand side. There's loads of nice photographs of memories. There's a 2017 World Championships back in the London Olympic Stadium, and there's a photo of me and my dad celebrating winning my last world title, and it was just me and my dad fisting each other, putting the fist together, and it was just the emotions in our faces were just like, it was like the realization we had just done the double again, we had ticked all the boxes that we needed to do, the pressure was off, because ironically that was my last ever win in Paralympic sport. And to look back at that photograph every time I walk into my parents' house is quite nice to know that. And my son now goes, Dada, Dada. That again, that I've left a mark on that.
Yeah, that's class. We are skipping around a bit, but Rio, obviously, your final Paralympic, you weren't to know at the time. I presume you had expectations, obviously, beyond that final Paralympic medal. You were carrying an injury into Rio. Is that right? Cyst on your toe, or there was some...
I've had so many issues, and I think that's where my dad, I think, deserves so much respect, is the simple fact he always found a way of getting me in shape. Mm-hmm. And again, like I talked about, winning races, you don't have to be the best and you don't have to be the fittest. You have to be the smartest. Collectively, all that comes together, and I think that's where my racecraft came in the older I got, because the more injury prone I got. Going back to 2017, I had a sportsman hernia that I didn't know I had. I ran on painkillers on the two World Championship finals that I did. I got surgery 8 months after those championships because it wouldn't go away. They didn't know what was wrong with me. But it's just, it does show you that, like, I went to Rio, my third Paralympic Games, and yeah, I had an issue. I remember doing a workout 2 months or a month out from going to Rio, and it was the flattest I'd ever felt. And my dad was like, "We need your bloods done." I went and got bloods done, and I was like anemic.
Right.
And it's again, whenever you're in crisis, who do you call? Your team around you is massive. And for me, the Sports Institute up north, the Sports Institute down south, collectively came together and came up with a contingency plan to make sure that I was fit enough and healthy enough to be on the flight to Rio. But that goes back to, yes, I have the glory, the photos of me coming across the line and all. I have the medals, but in actual fact, there's so much more that goes into it than just me running around the track.
You mentioned about the pain and disappointment, and so we come full circle almost to Tokyo 2020. Is that so? You go out there from reading the quotes and stuff beforehand, there was still a hope that you could finish on a high. You were 31 years of age. It wasn't how it worked out. You finished eighth. So I asked you earlier on about your favourite child. Where does that rank in terms of your biggest disappointment? I know there was big disappointment in your final ever race as well, but...
Yeah, the disappointment, I think, in Tokyo was the realisation that my time was up within the sport. I knew I wasn't competitive anymore, and I step on the track every single time up until that moment to be the best and win medals. And I knew that I could be competitive because in the build-up, the week before, James Nolan, our Paralympic manager, still is, he did a workout with me. I don't know how he still did it, but his Achilles just about held on for being able to do it. But like, I remember I did 3x600 meters, and like the times that I ran there would have comfortably easily got me a medal. A week later, after replicating, because we replicate did the session at the same time, we kind of wore the same clothes apart from the singlet I never put on before I went in the race. I had the same shorts, the socks, the spikes, every single thing was exactly the same time, and went into the day of the race and I was just completely flat. And to this day, I've never watched the race because I don't understand what actually went wrong. I still remember going round after about a K going, "What am I doing here?"
Right.
And I just knew at that moment in time, all I needed to do was take those spikes off. And I don't know if there is a photograph, but I took my spikes off and I put them on the track and walked away. Because I knew personally myself that I just wasn't up to it anymore.
But you didn't know that before the race started?
No, I didn't. Not in my head. I knew kind of potentially if it doesn't go well, because I would always have been very positive and that. But then obviously COVID had probably came at the wrong time, because it's a year later. It's a year without physio. You kind of were locked up and that sort of stuff. But I got myself into really good shape and I believed in myself. But I don't know what went wrong. And my dad sent me a photograph a couple of days later, and it was me on the start line, and he goes... And I was white as a sheet. And he was like, "That is not a person that was going to win a Paralympic gold medal. That is a person that is checked out." Even though I didn't think I checked out, I obviously had checked out. And unfortunately, that happens to people that stay in the game too long. And looking back now, should I have retired after 2017, winning a double gold in the London Stadium in front of my family and friends? Probably. But I was never in a position, probably because I didn't have an education. I didn't have the job to fall back on. So all I kept doing was becoming the best athlete I possibly could and keep dragging my feet on, because I didn't know what would come after. And the afterlife is scary for people.
Letting your dad down was a big part of that post-2022.
Yeah. Yeah, huge. He had put so much time and effort into my career. What it meant to him, probably, I thought at the time, felt more than what I had believed. But realistically, and I now know as a father, you're his son. All he cares about is his son, nothing else. And if it goes well, if it doesn't go well, who cares? Because I'll be able to go and sit at the kitchen table with him, have a conversation, have a cup of tea, do whatever I need to do, and realise that he's my dad. But sometimes, again, separating those two identities was tough at times. And now that I'm in coaching and that sort of stuff, I can go to my dad and ask for advice and ask for help. But if I had have created that relationship of you're just my coach, that to me would never have went down well in future life, because you could never separate. But the separation we had was father-son. We went and played golf. We didn't talk about running. We didn't talk about anything else. We talked about Arsenal. We talked about whatever it may have been, but we never talked about running, because we needed to separate the professionalism and the father-son bond. And I think we worked out well at that stage.
Will you? We mentioned at the very start about your vast majority of your time spent being a stay-at-home dad. Will you encourage the not-yet two-year-old, admittedly, will you encourage him into sport if that's something that he's showing signs of?
100%. I think there's so much to be gained from being involved in sport, not just running. I would never want him to go, oh, you have to be a runner. I want him to be whatever he wants to be, whether that's in team sport, whether that's in hurling, Gaelic, whatever. I would love him to play hurling. Like that for me would be unbelievable to see him play in a... I had him in his Antrim jersey yesterday. We were down in Cushendall, where I'm originally from, and walking around the town, and there's so many young kids walking around in their Cushendall jersey or their Antrim jersey, and that for me is a dream and an ambition. Like, my dad had an involvement in Cushendall hurling back in the early 90s as their fitness coach whenever they won the Ulster titles. So for me, I always have that love for it. And you've got the likes of Neil McManus, who is a trailblazer from the town, and is now doing obviously RTE work and that sort of stuff, and he's made a name for himself because he's an unbelievable person. And if you ever get to speak with Neil, you're always left with such a real good understanding of who he is, a proper man, if you know what I mean, in a way that he's so respectful and has so much knowledge. And I think if my son could go in and learn from people within the GAA, it would be incredible. But like I said, sport can take you anywhere, and it's about taking advantage of sport for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons.
Yeah. You can get those little hurling sets, you know, the little...
Oh, don't worry, he's already got his own hurl. He had one when it was like this size, he got a custom made, and then now I think he's got a 22-inch stick now that he walks around, and we have a big massive ball, so he's at the back battering down on a stick. So, like, for me, that's... It puts a smile on my face because I'm sure that's what I was like when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah, brilliant. I should have mentioned at the start, Dr. Michael MacKillop, MBE, to give it your full title. How often do you step up to people and go, nice to meet you, Dr. MacKillop?
Well, it depends. It depends on where I am, realistically. And again, it divides opinion and divides a lot of people of what it actually is, and probably divides people a lot more up north than it does down south. Obviously, having doctor in the front of my name is quite cool, because it's like just people automatically think you're a doctor, when in actual fact they don't have a clue about anything.
It was from Queen's.
It was Queen's University in Belfast.
Of your voice around disability sport.
Disability sport and achievements within my athletics. And like I said, I sacrificed a lot of my life not to go to university. I didn't get that privilege or opportunity to. I could have, but I never did, like I explained. But like the accepting of obviously an MBE didn't go down well with a lot of people, but I felt like I've grown up within Northern Ireland. That's where I grew up, that's where I live. And I respect everyone, it doesn't matter, and that's how I grew up, respect everyone, and whatever comes my way. And if they feel it's necessary to award me it, then who am I to say no? And again, that might not go down with some of your listeners, but for me, I was always brought up, my uncle and my aunties are English, and I love them for who they are, not just because they're a certain side of the community or not. And I think for me, it's important for people to appreciate it, because I've had ex-family members now not appreciate it at the time, and it didn't go down well, very, very well with my family. It's a comment what I received has left a lasting mark on accepting something like that. But for me, it's important.
It's hard for people this side of the border, I suppose, to get their head around that, but that's close to home.
And I think, again, it's appreciating for what it actually is. And for me, it was accepting appreciation for the hard work and dedication that I put into not only, I talk about, like I said, the island of Ireland, because obviously up the north is a completely different identity than it is the south. So for me, I have to know where I came from and where I grew up, and knowing that what I've done, I do it for the people of the island of Ireland.
Yeah, it's a complex thing, and we've touched on it quite a bit over the course of our conversation. You've been very eloquent about it, so I think people will take that in the round. You've been very open. Thanks, Mary, for coming in. What's next outside of the stay-at-home dad aspect of things? The coaching thing is something that's hopping out for me here.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, if there's any listeners out there that wants to come on board and be helped to achieve a life goal, whether that's running your first ever 5K or your marathon, get in touch, reach out to me. Like, I aspire to take people to the next level. That's what my kind of, like, tag line is, like, next level performance. You'll start at a certain level, whatever you think you are capable of, I'm going to take you beyond that, because if you're educated in the right possible way, in the right ways, you'll gain to love something. When you love something, you can embrace it more and more and find that purpose. And for me, yeah, that's where I want to improve, because I'm still improving as a coach. And then the likes of my own personal ambitions, I'm doing triathlon, and I have the National Para Championships coming up next weekend in Uma, so we'll see where that takes me. But yeah, well, that ends me in Venice Beach in LA, I don't know, but we'll wait and see.
It sounds like a good way to wrap things up. Michael McKillop, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Settle in on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 0.0.